You are listening to the Marty Leeds Mathematical Radio Hour, where we discuss myth, math, spirituality, philosophy, and much, much more. www.thesyncbook.com. Hello, fellow travelers, seekers, and luminaries. Hope everyone is doing well. This show this week is kind of a change of pace for me, just having some fun here, and this is more of a casual setting than I usually do. When I first started this show, I wanted to play the role of an interviewer and sort of step into that role for just mainly the challenge of it. And though I really appreciate the more sort of conversational roundtable approach that many other podcasts seem to be gravitating towards, I wanted to do a more traditional show. I've always been a fan of the sort of NPR, Charlie Rose way of conducting a show, and that's how I envision this broadcast. And I have to be honest with the listeners, I'm not much of a conversationalist when it comes right down to it. I've never considered myself to be a public speaker. I'm forever stumbling over my words and tripping over my tongue. I tend to curse too much, and you know, I lack articulation a lot of the times. And I think that's one of the reasons that I think I needed to start this whole Marty Leeds Mathematical Radio Hour show, was to try to overcome some of these fears and some of my own awkwardness. And overcoming one's fears is a theme that we actually discuss on this episode. Our guests tonight are a few online friends of mine who host their own podcasts, Greg and Michael. And we spoke for about 2 hours or so, and I've just included the first hour here. And I'll be posting a bonus podcast with the rest of our conversation, so look forward to that. I love these guys. I have a lot of respect for what they do. They're both really open-minded, intelligent, thoughtful, well-spoken guys who have a ton of heart, 2 tons of humility, and 3 tons of passion. And this show was just, it was just a lot of fun to do. So I have to apologize for my lack of professionalism on my part. My mic was really hot during this interview, and I didn't realize it, so I kind of sound like I'm in a fishbowl the whole time, so my apologies. It's really funny, because one of the first things that Greg had mentioned prior to us starting the show was that no matter what comes of the show, you know, it should at least sound good, since, you know, we're all podcasters, and if it doesn't sound good, we should probably reevaluate what we do, and lo and behold, I screw up the audio, so not the first time, and certainly won't be the last. You know, I'm, you know, 20, 21 episodes or so into the show, and this is still a learning process for me, and as the great songwriter and poet extraordinaire Joni Mitchell once said, life is for learning. So I appreciate your patience. I appreciate you sticking with me. Alrighty, my friends, let's do this. Our guests tonight are from the podcast The Higher Side Chats, Greg Carlwood, and from the podcast Midwest Reel, Michael Phillip, and the musical guest is The Moon Gypsies. This show is brought to you by The Syncbook Radio. Check out all the wonderful podcasts. 42 Minutes, Always Record, Astro Music, Pentimental, and Synchronize. More information about Syncbook Press, Syncbook Radio, and Syncbook events can be found at www.thesyncbook.com. If you like this podcast, please share it with your friends and please support it by becoming a donor. You'll find the donation links under each episode on the website, and please consider setting up a monthly charge, as it helps us keep the lights on and helps keep our microphones humming. And as always, thank you for your support.
TheSyncBook.com is nearing the end of a massive upgrade, which means that so much cool stuff is coming, but it also means that access to parts of the website will be restricted from January 15th to January 28th. It also means that we need your help during this time and want to give you really neat stuff as a thank you. Everyone who registers at TheSyncBook.com/beta will receive an exclusive sample chapter from Marty Leeds' forthcoming book, and an exclusive video clip from the Olympia Sync Summit. Everyone, and for a limited number of you willing to get your hands dirty in a digital sort of way, there's something extra special we're giving away. A book that people have spent years waiting and asking us for. If your beta tester application is accepted, remember there's only a limited number of positions available, we will give you nearly the entire 2012 draft of Suicide Kings. Please visit thesyncbook.com/beta right away. Even with non-linear phenomena, time is of the essence.
And there was this one little runt that could, you know, wanted to get up there and couldn't really get access to the teat. I went in and just simply, you know, just into a little saucer. And then took the saucer and fed it to Geppetto. That's what I named him, Geppetto.
I had no idea you could milk a cat.
Oh, yeah, you can milk anything with nipples.
I have nipples, Greg. Could you milk me?
Can I ask you something?
What?
You know I like you, don't you?
Yes.
And I hope you like me the way I like you.
Yes.
I was wondering if you would be my girl.
Oh, Michael.
So without further ado, let's get pious with Greg Carlwood and Michael Phillip.
Greg, Michael, gentlemen, and I say that loosely, gentlemen, welcome to the show. What's happening, guys?
Thanks, man. Thanks. It's a real honor and a pleasure.
Yes. I like this three-way combo. This is a good one. Thank you for having me.
This is not the three-way that I always hope for in life, but you know what? You take what you can get, right?
Right. Beggars can't be choosers.
That's right.
I don't believe that at all, man. I think this is exactly the one you wanted.
we'll talk about that after the show, Mike. So, yeah, I mean, thanks for coming on. I know I asked you guys about several weeks ago to do this, and I'm just getting around to doing it. So, and I'm glad we're going to get a chance to shoot the bull here. I think this is going to be fun. So, do you guys want to give a little, you know, blurb about to everyone who you are and your shows and that sort of thing?
Sure. I'm Greg Carlwood. I run the Higher Side Chats podcast. We tackle all conspiracies, mysteries, and all anything fringe, cryptozoology, UFOs, MK Ultra, hidden history, magic, reptilians, archons, the full conspiratorial cornucopia.
Yes. And I'm Michael Phillip. I run a show called Midwest Real. It's pretty loose as far as the subject matter. I would just say we enjoy diving down various rabbit holes and kind of just engaging in open-minded inquiry on all kinds of subjects from, you know, philosophy, stuff that's a little bit more out there, science, technology, pretty much everything.
Mm-hmm. So, I wanted to have you guys on together, first off, because I'm a big fan of both your guys' podcasts. I mean, I don't get a chance to listen to too many podcasts anymore, but when I do, I try to hit both your guys' shows. I like the stuff on the Sync Book, of course. Psychedelic Salon, that's another one of my favorite ones. What do you guys, get a chance to listen to podcasts? And if so, what do you guys listen to?
I definitely listen to some shows, but they're typically ones that are not in the conspiracy field because I just get too much of that in doing the research for the guests and all that. So I like comedy shows. I like Duncan Trussell. I like Joe Rogan depending on the guest. I like a show called Red Bar Radio. It's a smaller show, and it's really, really offensive. So you got to brace yourself. It's almost like a guilty pleasure, but that's a fun one. So, yeah, pretty much comedy shows, but there's so many good topics. Dan Carlin's Hardcore History is good, too.
Yeah. I'm actually right there with you, man. Those are three of my favorites as well. Duncan Trussell, Family Hour, Rogan. I also listen to Hardcore History. I've been listening to philosophy podcast called Philosophize This. It's more like straightforward philosophy. So it's like if you just want, a concise rundown of a lot of the more mainstream philosophers in terms of like what it is that they, actually knowing what you're talking about when it comes to some of the great minds in history, I think that's a great, really digestible show. So yeah, I'm kind of right there with you, Greg.
And so,
of course, the math. Radio hour. I mean, God.
I mean, come on. You know, that's just a given. That shit's on repeat 24 hours a day, right?
I got to give a shout out to Daniele Bellelli too. He's always got great shows, and he's such a great guy. So his show's definitely worth checking out as well.
You guys have both interviewed him, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah. He's supposed to do this show as well. So he seems like a really great guy. So.
Yes.
Yeah,
man. He's one of the most transparent, just straightforward, no bullshit, you know, down for anything people I've encountered since I began my internet exploits a couple of years ago.
When did you guys both start?
Man, I thought I've been saying like 2.5 years, but somebody just recently asked me to find this Michael Tesarion interview, which was one of the first conspiracy ones I did. It is like the 11th show total. And it was in May of 2011. So I was like, wow, I guess I have been at this thing for a lot longer than I thought.
Yeah. And on my end, like about 2 years, I think I broke 2 years in December. So it's been 2 years, about 60 and change shows. So not quite as long as Greg, but but I've been fucking around for a while now.
Yeah, man.
So... Okay, you know, you guys are both like really good interviewers. I really like both your guys' styles. They're very like different styles, but and you know, one of the things that I wanted to have you guys on was talk about like kind of the state of the world and the world of podcasting, that sort of thing, and your own journey as into like how you got here. Like why did you guys start podcasting in the first place?
Yeah,
go ahead.
Well, for me, it was pretty organic. I'm the type of person, I guess, that sort of gravitates toward, you know, what makes you tick as a person. Like, I don't want to, you know, shoot the shit and have the kind of stereotypical small talk with people I meet. Like, I'm kind of the guy who within 5 minutes of meeting me, I'm kind of just wearing my, you know, my heart on my sleeve, and I'm digging for what, you know, what yours... what yours is as well, you know? So for me, I just have always gravitated toward these conversations, and it kind of just so happened. I was playing in a band with a guy a couple of years back, and he was kind of pushing the issue, like, why don't we just start our own podcast? So we kind of, you know, hemmed and hawed for a while about how we were going to do it. Got a couple of other friends who were doing creative stuff on board. Long story short, we tried it as a foursome for, I don't even know how many episodes, maybe like 10, 12, 15 episodes or something. And, eventually it got down to just me. So I've been kind of rolling by myself for the last 50 or so episodes. And it's been really great. I've gotten to talk to some people I obviously never otherwise would have spoken to. You know, the show's gone from basically just friends and family listening to thousands of weirdos that I interact with on a pretty regular basis now. So it's been pretty great.
Yeah, man. I guess the way I started was about that time. I guess late 2011. I was living in Missouri, where I grew up in St. Louis, and I really, really hated my job in retail as a store manager. But I just figured, you know, that's the example I saw from my dad, who I love, but the man did not like his job. So I just grew up thinking, well, you know, I'm going to enjoy life till about 21, 24, and then it's just going to suck. I'm going to raise kids, and that's going to be cool, and I'm going to like them, but I'm going to hate my own life. That's just what's going to happen. And as much as I was ready to just deal with that, like so many people do, it was a particular year where they blamed a lot of things on the economy, and my job took a pay cut. And I was like, wow, now this is a new level of abuse. I don't know if I'm going to take this. And that's when I took all the money I had saved to buy a house, and I just moved to California, and I didn't really know what I wanted to do. I wanted to do some type of writing / comedy / stand-up. I really did not know. And then podcasting fell into that. And luckily, that's the one that stuck. And going into conspiracy was like probably one of my biggest interests. And Yeah, so now I feel like I know it so much better just by being involved in all the material, but it has been a fun ride, and I'm so glad that I did not take the abuse of that stupid job that was just going to cut my pay. And I know people who still work for the same company, and it's a struggle. It happens, but I'm glad that was the straw that broke the camel's back for me.
Yeah, I think you brushed up against a really key thing there, Greg, which is like, everybody kind of has this yearning and they want to do something, but it's what vessel are you going to apply that into? You know, you were confused about where to focus your energy. And I think that's kind of the boat that the vast majority of young people are in, is like, mm-hmm. I want to do something. I want to do my own thing, but how can I figure out what to do, like how to focus it? And I'm even in that same boat right now. You know, I'm not making a living off of my show by any means. And, you know, I've considered all types of things, like, you know, I've even had some chats with you about this, Greg, about, mm-hmm. you know, how to take everything to the next level. So I think it's definitely just try something, you know, like you will learn lessons along the way, and you'll learn what kind of does work and what doesn't work. And if you try something that doesn't work, you'll have a better idea of something that will work next time around. So I think it's just about kind of taking the leap and trying something.
Mm-hmm. That's such an important lesson in life, is like taking a chance, you know, like Greg, you were just talking about taking the money that you were, you know, to buy a house and just moving to California. Michael, you just said that you were, was it just like last week or something like that? You went to a job interview in San Fran. It didn't necessarily, you know, pan out, but you know, sometimes it's like, you still got to shoot for that. If you don't do that, you're never going to get anywhere in life. And how many people I know, at least living back in Wisconsin and things like that, they never took a shot at anything. And yet, and they end up working at that retail store, hating their life, you know. And that's that mold that was laid out. I think it's laid out for a lot of people in their life. Like, hey, you're 24 years old. Life's going to suck now. It's just a mold I always wanted to break.
Yeah, I hear you, man. And another thing about it is, now that I'm on the other side, it doesn't sound scary anymore. But for years, and I wanted to get out of the trajectory of a soulless job I cared nothing about. I wanted to get out of that so bad, but I was paralyzed for years. And now that I'm on the other side, it's like, what was I so scared about? Because I had in my mind that my job was secure, but it isn't really, because you can have your job for 10 years. You mess up once, they'll fire you in a second, and they'll never remember your name. That's not security. There's no loyalty there. A lot of people, when they after they've already spent the years of their life to get a pension that they're promised, they go to collect it and it's gone. Oh, you're going to give me 30 years of my life back, AT&T? Because I don't know how I'm going to get that. So I guess people should be less they shouldn't have the mindset that that's the security, because now my income comes from listeners and people who buy T-shirts and stuff like that. My income on a monthly basis comes from hundreds of different sources. So for it to be unsecure, I mean, my whole show would have to end. You know, that's all in my power. For everyone to drop off at one time, I mean, I don't see that happening as easy as it would be for Subway to fire you or for The Gap to just let you go. You know, so I think it sounds scary, but if I could offer any advice, it would be to think of it like that. Think of it like you're not really in a secure situation now. So why not get risky? You already kind of are.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And we also don't know what's going to come with, you know, any given month, any given year. I mean, look at what happened in 2008, 2009 with all these industries taking a dive and, you know, forcing everybody to start laying people off. That really has nothing practically to do with any of the three of us, and that's completely out of our control. And the only way that you can have control is by doing your own thing or by controlling your own destiny and taking it into your own hands. And that inevitably does take a leap of faith to even, you know, begin to do. But there's this like Terrence McKenna quote along the lines of like, if you leap into the abyss, the universe will conspire to like meet you with a feather bed or something like that.
Yeah,
you know?
Nature rewards the courageous,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, And I don't know how I feel about, you know, the metaphysical nature of like destiny or something like that, but I do know for a fact that if you're not going to help yourself and you're not going to roll the dice, it's not going to happen for you. It's not just going to appear. I've never met one person that is just like, yeah, man, I don't know what happened. And I'm super rich and successful and happy now. Does anybody have an example of that? Because I definitely don't.
And failure breeds character. So failure and pain are great tools. I mean, that's the thing I learned from all the comedians that I have talked to is they are some of the coolest people. Duncan Trussell, one of my favorite people. I was lucky enough to have him on. And, you know, he basically says everything that made me up is from failure. And that's so true. When I think of the people that I like or even characters in a movie that are cool and have a lot of street smarts, it's because they suffered. Either they're the street orphan or whatever. But they're usually the characters that are the strongest people. And, you know, you can feel sorry for yourself for as long as you want and time will march on and you won't get any better. Or you can, you know, take some chances, take some falls, dust yourself off, put that in your experience box, you know, because if you sit there at the same job for 4 decades, your experiences are going to be very much the same. You're going to eat at the same lunch place every day. It's the same 9-to-5 job, 2 days off a week. You just want to relax. You know, you can go decades without a change in your life, but, you know, that is not what we're here for, I would say. And if I had to guess, it wouldn't be to be the best receptionist in the AT&T cubicle.
Yeah, absolutely not, man. Absolutely not. And again, you know, I'm not going to make too many, you know, statements about the metaphysical nature of why it is we're here and what we're all doing. But if you take an objective look at a human's body and what it can do, one of the main things that it can do is manipulate the matter around it, manipulate the space around it, and do that in a way that results in creating something. And, you know, lo and behold, every single person you talk to, who are the most satisfied people you know? Who are the people that are the most fully realized people you know? They're the people that have made something. They're the ones that have not been satisfied with their surroundings, not been followers, and like I said before, rolled the dice, mm-hmm. you know? And we live in this weird time now where we no longer have to, like, physically manipulate matter or space around us to create something. We're living in this weird time where the analog world is seeping into the digital world and vice mm-hmm. versa. And that affords us a whole new crazy series of possibilities that we never could have had in any other time. And I think that makes things extra exciting.
And it's never been easier to take that leap.
Yeah, no kidding, right? It's like there's so many avenues that are open to so many people now. It's like if you want to reach somebody, you know, if you want to learn how to play the guitar, it's never been easier to learn how to play the guitar. You can go to YouTube and, you know, learn from 50 different teachers in the first hour. You know what I mean? It's like almost like the universe has given us this opportunity to really sort of like realize, you know, self-realization, find out who we are in a way. And maybe that's cosmic cycles or something. I don't know what it is, but it's it's one of the most interesting times I think to live in ever, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it's almost like that right in that crossroads between the Matrix download. Like you just said, if you want to learn to play guitar, you can get on YouTube and watch those videos. That is one step away from just the download that you see in the Matrix. Like you want to know how to fly a pilot, just download the program. Essentially, that's what YouTube is. It's just, it takes a little while longer to take root, you know, but we are basically all that information, whichever amount you want to put into your brain and absorb, you can.
It's so funny that we're talking about this because just literally about like 3 days ago, I was talking to my friend Nathan about this very thing, about the pain that, you know, people have to go through, the heartache, you know, and that's really gratifying. That's really what makes a human being. And then I literally just watched The Matrix a couple days ago again. So a bunch of cool, crazy, you know, synchronicities happening. Since we're talking about that, like the pain, the strife, that sort of thing, what sort of like failures have you guys undergone that has made you better people? Has there any, you know, been like major ones in your life that have like, you know, strengthened your resolve?
I sort of feel like I'm in one right now based on, you know, based on that one that you mentioned earlier, man. Like I had, you know, what I thought, I mean, I didn't necessarily believe that I for sure had this job in San Francisco locked up, but you inevitably kind of get ahead of yourself mentally when you're being, you know, on the company's dime, you're getting flown out there, they're putting you up in a nice hotel. You, you know, all signs point to that, okay, this is mine to fuck up. Like, they're going to the trouble of bringing me out here. I think as long as I do a decent job in this interview, I'll be finding myself in San Francisco in the near future. I thought I knocked it out of the park. I thought I did really well. I thought I clicked with everybody I met. You know, I thought I answered every question. I thought I was extremely well prepared, and I still didn't get the offer. You know, so this is one of those times for me where I'm like, man, like, I was ready to go out to a really cool city. You know, I was thinking about rebooting my show, you know, do it, you know, all X, Y, Z, all these different things. And now I'm like, shit, like, I'm like, here I am. I'm still here. Like, I'm not really sure. I'm just completely back to the drawing board, you know? So it's kind of situations like this, I think, where I feel more ready to roll the dice again, you know, because it's like, good. Well, what do I have to lose? What do I have to lose? You know, like, I'm stuck in this kind of stagnant spot. So I might as well just, you know, shake up the magic eight ball again and see what happens.
Yeah. Greg, what about you, man?
You know, I just got done saying that all this struggle and failure builds character. And I have to be honest, I have been super lucky. I've had nets, I've had crutches, I've had a lot of support for pretty much everything. And maybe that's why some people think I'm a bit of a douchebag. But I get that. I could see how you could get that impression. I try to be conscious of it. I try to make myself have failures. Not really. But I did get kicked out of private school the first day of senior year. So that really knocked me off my pedestal because I kind of thought I was untouchable in those years. And when I was forced to go to a public school, big, scary, mysterious public school, when I have gone to school with all these people from kindergarten to senior year, for them to actually say, no, you can't come back. And I'm like, wow, like, no one's ever really been able to stop me from getting what I want like that. Then I couldn't get out of it. And that was really a humbling time. And I don't know, I think I learned a lot. I think it actually ended up being an amazing thing to step outside of the comfort zone in that way. But yeah, that was probably the biggest struggle. I mean, just, I thought retail was a struggle. I thought having the job I had and having no possible way of getting out of it or seeing any way to ever enjoy a holiday season again, you know, working in that industry, and all the salaries were essentially capped. I never thought I would be able to make more than 35, 40 grand a year. And I felt really screwed. And that was about 8 years of life. That felt like 8 years of failure. It really did.
Wow. Yeah. What one of the things that, like, basically kind of all of our shows have in common is that kind of conspiratorial angle. And one like common theme that I hear from so many different people, like I just the last show was with Vinnie Eastwood. I've heard him talk about this before, is that, you know, under, you know, when you start investigating conspiracies and things like that, that there's this point of depression. Like, it's like there's a hopelessness when you see the level of corruption and the lies and the distortions of truth and all of that sort of thing. Did you guys go through any of that sort of thing, since you guys are very steeped in this study?
Absolutely. It definitely can take a toll. But I really think it is just, I've had several guests who said, Kate Agaya is one who said it really well, and that it's not, when you're looking at the world as a whole, it's not good or evil. It's good and evil. Like, everything is connected in such a way that there are polar extremes, but they're not necessarily opposites. They're just polar extremes along, you know, a level of variance to whatever degree. And I think that life is like that too. You can focus on all the negativity of the conspiracy world. Yes, things are unfair. Yes, there's polarization and racial tensions and a huge income gap that's only getting worse. Mm-hmm. Or you can focus on the fact that never in history has it been easier to start your own business. You know, mm-hmm. Our parents had no choices. If they wanted to start a business, you had to somehow have the money to get a building. You don't need to do that anymore. For $100, you can have a website where, instead of paying for a couple hundred people to have foot traffic in front of your corner store location, you have infinite traffic on the internet for free. Rent is basically free here. You know, come make some money if you want to take some chances without really any risk. You can make a website and make a product with basically no risk. So, yeah, you can get depressed about the big conspiracy and the militarization of police and GMOs and chemtrails and all these things that really aren't stopping you from freeing yourself from the shackles of a debt-based system of rule.
Yeah, I think that's the key point, man, is just that we do live in a plentiful world. It's still a fucked up world. It still has countless things wrong with it, for sure. I mean, you know, on the question, does it make me depressed? There was a period of time where, you know, I first started looking into kind of the cliche, you know, who's who of conspiracy theories several years ago, where I did really think, you know, I had the total Big Brother complex, and I thought, you know, there was definitely, you know, people pulling strings and, you know, shadowy, you know, cabals, the man behind the throne type, you know, scenarios going on. But I think
the,
I've definitely
the Alex Jones years, right?
Right, yeah. And I think I've definitely relaxed that point of view a bit. But at the same time, I do definitely acknowledge, you know, and a lot of your work points to a lot of this stuff, Marty, as well as a lot of Scott Onstott's work. It's just there are so many interconnected winks and nudges and taps on the shoulder that I don't think all of it is bullshit, or all of it is just, you know, everybody's propensity to look for patterns and reoccurring themes and numbers. I think some of it is there, some of it isn't there. But at the end of the day, I don't really trip out too much over it, because what good is it going to do me? You know, right. Like what good is it going to do me whether it is or it isn't? And I think that's a really great point you made, Greg. It's like, take what you can take and what you can control and the circumstances you can influence, and use that. Use that in the way that you can use that to better your own situation. Don't worry about all of these external factors that are going to be there, whether or not, you know, you're sitting there Googling until 3 a.m. and getting down some like YouTube rabbit hole, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You guys, this is something that Lennon Honor touches on. I know he's been on your show, Greg, but
he's great.
Yeah, Lennon's great. Do you ever consider that like conspiracies are done, at least in one part, to keep people looking at everything so negatively, if you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely. That's one of the things about Lennon Honor I love most. I love the guy because he speaks so well and he's so positive, and he's one of those people that just radiates that type of energy that you're like, I gotta get some of that. Whatever he smokes, give me some.
And he doesn't smoke anything. He's got like 5 freaking kids anything. Too. I don't know how he does it.
I know. I know. He doesn't drink, doesn't smoke. The guy, he's a beast. Mm-hmm. And he talks about the idea that nothing ever really happens, that all these terror attacks are staged media events. And that is a far out conspiracy theory. I mean, people who are looking into that stuff are pretty deep down there, because for a lot of people, it's a tough pill to swallow. Even me, we talk about it all the time, and we look at the evidence that shows or makes the case that some of these events do have staged elements to them. If not the whole event, at least there's some staged elements with crisis actors. And I have a hard time with it, because I just think, if these events are caused by the elites, they don't care about human life. They've shown that. So why do they go to the trouble to totally manipulate it and everything for the cameras? But I don't know. Lennon makes some really good points, as well as some other people. But if not that they're staged themselves, the attention drawn to them is definitely there to, you know, keep you distracted. I actually talk about it quite a bit on the show when I have guests and they're going off about the Rockefellers and the Rothschilds and how enslaved we are. I say, well, what do we do about it? You know, because sometimes I feel like we're stuck in the educational circle jerk. You know, how many years are we going to talk about the crimes of the puppet masters before we cut the strings?
Yeah, that's a great point. Yeah.
So I don't know. Yeah, I think it's definitely keeps people distracted. And that's why I always try to bring up, okay, so we've talked about it for X amount of time now. Where do you go from there? And no one really knows. It's a tough road to hoe, for sure.
Given that fact, like, do you ever feel like some of the conversations you have, because, you know, it's kind of like a blessing and a curse to have a focus on a show. Like, you can't, like, your show focuses really on conspiracy and, you know, things within that wheelhouse. So it kind of restricts you personally on the content that you can explore. Do you ever feel like man, like I don't want to have this conversation again? Or do you, or is it like every single show you find something to be, you know, intrigued by or happy about?
I would say that I say it's a conspiracy show to simplify it, but I do have a pretty wide net. I mean, Daniele Bolelli, we talked to him sure, about Taoism. I talked to people who are into chaos magic or Thelema magic about their brands of stuff. Marty's been on the show, and that wasn't largely about conspiracy, but conspiracy also ties in a lot of secret societies and their hidden knowledge, which ultimately seems like, the more I've learned about it, is to enlighten man. So there is a connection to a lot of positive stuff that's been hidden from us, and the hiding of it is the conspiracy. But once we get past that and we realize there's something in that treasure box, once we pop it open, I mean, we can do a lot of shows on a lot of positive things that we find in there. So that allows me to widen the net. I'm not like Alex Jones. I don't fear monger. I don't monger fear. I monger hope and, you know, curiosity, essentially. So, yeah, there is definitely that distinction that needs to be made, I guess, because Alex Jones is who everybody thinks of when they think conspiracy. But I don't yell too much, and I try to be more positive. But, yeah, I mean, the reason that it doesn't get repetitive is because I choose the guests. So I make sure that if I have a couple people who are just like, you know, chemtrails, MK Ultra mind control, reptilians, I say, okay, well, let's take a break. Let's breathe a minute and let's have some Taoism next week. So I do get some flexibility. But yeah, if I was like Alex Jones, I mean, to me, that's the same show every time.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Definitely.
How do you guys choose the guests for your shows? Because it seems like, I mean, Greg, maybe because you do more shows or whatever, I mean, it seems like you're willing to talk to really anybody, where, like, Michael, you seem like you're, you know, asking particular people on. Or is that, I mean, where do you get your guests? Do they ask to be on your show? That sort of thing.
Yeah, for me, it's both. I mean, when I first started, it was definitely, you know, nobody listened and nobody knew who I was. So it was more like, you know, trying to convince people to come on the show in the early goings. And of course that still does happen to an extent. You know, if you want to like catch a big fish, sometimes you got to do some work, and you know, it takes a while. But you know, yeah, for me, if I hear somebody on another show or there's a topic I want to explore, I might start researching that topic and finding out, you know, what people out there are talking about transhumanism or something. And then I'll start, you know, getting a list of names, watching some, you know, TED Talks, listening to some podcasts, figuring out like who do I want to talk about, or who do I want to talk about the subject with. So, you know, it's really all over the place in terms of how we book guests. And yeah, I mean, guests do reach out to me now from time to time to say like, hey, I want to be on your show. So it really is all over the place. What about you, Greg?
Yeah, I would say there's definitely a mix of both. There are those people who contact me because they've heard of the show and they have a book out. There are those people that I track down. But when I choose guests, it's pretty much, I like to think about what I've been covering lately and switch gears. So I really don't have too many shows in a row that focus on the same thing. You know, if I do Randall Carlson, we talk about sacred geometry and lost history and catastrophism. Next week, I'm talking to Kata Gaia about the legal name illusion, the triple crown control, and the 444 Hertz conspiracy. And then it's, you know, blood sacrifices in the Illuminati in Hollywood. So I try to take whatever show I did last week, and sometimes I'm like, okay, what's the furthest thing from that? And within this framework, you know, what's on the opposite end? And yeah, I don't know. That's generally how I've been doing it. But there are those people who reach out. But that's good. You know, anyone who's out there on the internet using it for connecting to people and putting out some form of truth when we've been really had our educational channels whittled away to nearly nothing until the internet came on the scene. And now it's just like, bam. And I can only imagine that this is just the beginning. We can still remember a pre-internet. We can remember pre-cell phones. You know how many movies you go back and watch and you're like, if they had cell phones, this whole movie would be ruined. There'd be no Goonies. If they had iPhones, Goonies is over. It's a 2-minute movie. So I don't know. It's kind of cool. We're in crazy times. I'm loving it. And yeah, they're also really bad times. 85 people have as much wealth as half the people on the planet. I'm reading stats now that say by 2016, they're going to even increase that like 50% more. And it's like, yeah, that is scary. But at the same time, there are opportunities.
Yeah, man. Why is it that the Elon Musks and the Richard Bransons have to be the exception to the 1%, man? We need to recruit more 1% people to do the work that needs to be done, because if we don't, it's all of this, you know, like nepotism and quid pro quo that just keeps the trajectory and the momentum going in the way that it's been, favoring the circumstances and the way that they are, relying on oil, relying on, you know, cartels of, you know, Silicon Valley companies and fossil fuel companies, and it just can't keep going that way. Like we need to do something to disrupt that track, but it just really, based upon what you said, doesn't seem like it's gonna go that way. So what do you guys think is going to be, if there is going to be something that reverses that trend or shifts the trend, what is that going to be?
That's, you know, that's such a good question, man, because to me, it's all about education. You know, it's all about, you know, it, like, you know, it's like the thing with, your self-evident rights, you know, creator rights, things like that. That's something that people should know, that your rights come before laws. If people were educated about things like that, I think our entire, you know, police system would change. And that, but of course, who would have to be educated? That would have to be the police, you know? So to me, education is the thing that's going to change it. I don't think anything else will, because if people are stuck in their ignorant boxes, you know what I mean? They're just, you know, of course they're just going to breed, and then they're going to get those kids stuck in those boxes, basically just like we were in one respect. And no offense to my parents or anything like that, but they grew up in the school system. They sent me to a school system that is an indoctrination camp. It's not there to teach you about, you know, true astronomy and geography and geology and anatomy and, you know, true mathematics and things like that. It's there to indoctrinate you. So without education, we're not going to change shit.
I mean, great point. You're right. I mean, education is so key, but I guess I've been in education for so long, as well as you, both you guys, it is easy to still look around and you see some of the ridiculous things people are saying and paying attention to, and you're like, yeah, we're still not there with education. We still need more of it. But when you're looking into this stuff for so long, you start to feel like, okay, yeah, I've heard it. Now what? Now what are we going to do? And I don't see very many people at all working on that next step. And it's a complicated step, and it's a hard step. I don't necessarily know what to do about it. I guess I'm just looking for a leader to follow myself in that regard. But, you know, there are a lot of educated people, and I don't know how many people it really takes to make a huge difference. But there's not a lot of organization. You know, the system is very well organized. The corporations usually don't work against each other. They usually circle their wagons against any outside threats. So the old power networks are tough to penetrate, and a lot of things won't change until we do. But like you mentioned about the indoctrination camp of school, they had been whittling away our channels for so long, the way we get our food, the way we educate our kids. They were trying to basically corral us into certain areas, and the internet just blew that wide open. I mean, I hate to keep throwing that out there, but even food. You know, I subscribe to something called Nature Box, where they send me a box for $20 a month. You get 5 snacks from their lineup, which are all natural, good things. So now I'm not getting Cheetos at 7-Eleven. My house has got oat clusters and whatever the hell they're throwing at me. And that's because of the internet. Like, I have been able to change the options that were provided. You know, some people, you can talk about, is this design, or is it coincidence, or is it just happen to be what's more profitable? Is removing nutrients from food, or is it a campaign against them? You know, you can argue all day, but the fact remains is, like, the food at the grocery store isn't good for you. I don't really care if it's a campaign against you or just Kellogg's trying to save a buck. I need another option. And thank God I've been able to get one that my parents couldn't get. And that goes for education. You can learn about new schools, new types of schools, if you even need that. You know, if you want to do homeschooling, send your kid to a public school where they're not getting much education. And then every night, pick 4 YouTube videos that you're going to make them watch and do a report on for you. So then you can add to their education. You can decide what's going to be important. Randall Carlson, who does sacred geometry, he actually does online classes, you know, $100 if you want to teach your kid sacred geometry. So there are all kinds of options. And, you know, I guess people are just going to have to take the individualized approach. I don't know if we're ever going to be able to stand up to riot cops and really change anything. I don't know if we're ever going to topple, you know, any kind of government, but I mean, it's just going to have to be on an individual basis. And
that's exactly what I've been talking about. In fact, I just had this sort of like argument or whatever on, with somebody on Facebook, not even an argument. I just kind of blew it off. But, you know, there's no way to fight the power as far as like, you know, violently or using force or physically, because it's just too strong. So the only way to really, you know, basically break those gates down is to educate people. Because if, you know, that's what I meant by with the police force, if the police force are educated and actually realize that they are breaking rights, human rights, you know, if they can understand that, then they're going to stop doing that. You know what I mean? They're going to stop acting in the way that they do. To me, there's no other way, because I don't think, you know, it's Martin Luther King Day, right? Martin Luther King Jr. Day. So, you know, I think one of his like famous quotes is that, you know, you're never going to repel violence with violence, right? You know, it's true. I'm paraphrasing or whatever, but I think that that's absolutely true, because there's no way that I just don't really feel like there's no way that we're going to win using violence, you know?
You know what really gives me the most hope is I feel like now, again, because of the internet and channels like Reddit, we are living in this kind of postmodern, transparent, open source, hive mind time where, you know, yeah, none of us individually do have as much power as, you know, the 1%, the AT&T, the Comcast, the federal government, but yet you still do see all of these groups of people getting together and, you know, forcefully putting their opinion out there. And we have seen examples of that influencing policy, influencing big corporations. You know, like the net neutrality debate has been a big one. Like that has largely stayed in the public sphere because of people like us making noise on Reddit. You know, like I check Reddit technology almost every day, and I'm always like, here we go again, more net neutrality shit. But thank God that it's net neutrality shit at the top of that category every day, at the top of that subreddit every day, because it's keeping that in the public consciousness. It's keeping that on people's minds. It's keeping people angry. It's keeping people talking. And that leads to, you know, Barack Obama getting on television talking about the necessity for higher internet speeds and net neutrality. And, you know, I'm no huge Obama fan, but that is indisputably a great thing. And, you know, like we, like us not bombing Syria, that was largely because of people like us getting online and making a bunch of noise and saying, we're not going to fucking do this again. So, and yes, of course we are bombing ISIS in Syria now daily, but you know, it does seem like if there's one way that we're going to make a difference, it's going to be by being a bunch of noisy assholes on the internet. And I think that's a beautiful thing.
Amen, man. I would suggest to both you guys as podcasters, I just did an interview with a girl named Jennifer Briney, and it hasn't aired yet, but she does her own podcast called Congressional Dish. And what she does is at the start of the last Congress, every Congress is, it's every 2 years. 2 years ago, she decided for the 113th Congress, she was going to read every bill that passed the House. And she did it. And she has become like an authority on the bills that are coming into government. And, you know, it sounds boring, but when you see how bold they're getting with their scams and their schemes and their scandals, it's actually really exciting to see. And that's getting into, like, we need to get involved with our government on a small level. Like, yes, the big stuff is rigged. I totally think that there's not much we can do about who's going to be president. But we've got representatives in every district in this country that are just ripping off the people, not giving a shit, taking corporate lobbyist money and just laughing all the way to the bank. We can do something about that. You know, with this podcast that she has, and she is so just on point and articulate. And she just outlines several of the things they've done over the last 2 years. And, you know, if we were paying attention, they wouldn't be so bold about just screwing us over. They'd actually have to like be a little trickier about it. But one thing we can say that's good about the system we have is when you go through Congress, everything's got to be documented. You've got to write a bill down to get it. You know, you want to put fluoride in people's water, you got to write that down and you got to vote on it. So, you know, there's evidence for all that stuff. We don't have to speculate about reptilians or, you know, the magic rituals going on in the basements of record companies. I mean, that stuff's all fun to speculate about, but the crimes that are going on in our government, they're right there on the paper. And if we actually shine a spotlight on it like she's doing, I mean, that is where we could get real change. That might be the next step.
Yeah, for sure. Unless you identify the cancer, you're not going to eradicate it. And I think that's a huge problem because there are all of these so deeply entrenched societal power structures that we almost take them for granted. Like we just take for granted that, yeah, we need dollars. We need dollars. We can't just live off of bitcoins. You know, it's like we just take it for granted that these things are going to always be there. We need them. We need Congress. We need these laws. We need, you know, whatever these pillars of society are to keep things going. But that's what's another beautiful thing about the time we're living in is we do have things like Bitcoin. We do have things like this girl's podcast that are shining a light on the extremely ridiculous, you know, things that we've been doing for the past however many hundreds of years that we just don't need to do anymore. We just don't need that. It's not necessary. And there are real alternatives that are cropping up now. And that also wouldn't be possible without this whole crazy, you know, explosion of knowledge and, you know, technology that we have at our disposal.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the things that seems to be coming up a lot is the idea of statism, right? There's kind of a libertarian movement that's coming up organically, really, recognizing that so many of our issues are the state in and of itself. In fact, I had Gregory Sams on here. He wrote the book, The State is Out of Date, where he just kind of goes point by point and says, look, where's your issue? Where's your problem? Where does it come from? Well, it comes from the state. So when we say, well, do we even need this anymore? Is there a way for this many people to function without this sort of like overarching oversight, you know, this sort of, you know, pseudo authority figure? I mean, yeah. What do you guys think?
Totally. I think you could get rid of the federal government within 30 days and just get every state prepared to run their own little area. And state governments would be able to do pretty much everything. I don't understand.
Essentially, that's what our country was set up to do, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It seems super easy to me.
That's a great point. And I mean, there's so much systemic rot and corruption that we do know about and that we don't know about. And I think the stuff that we do know about, we for sure need to do something about. But I also think that the way the system is set up is just to do nothing but pump money. I mean,
yes.
Especially with campaign finance reform, like it's just super clear that every politician is in the back pocket of some special interest, particularly oil in our country. And that just can't continue. It just can't continue. And I mean, I would just love to put the government on the boogeyman pedestal and say, look, there they are. Fuck them. Like, we don't need them at all. We don't need their authority. We don't need their protection. We don't need their roads, whatever. But when I look around the world, there are examples of countries that are doing a whole lot better and are a whole lot happier and aren't dealing with just the systemic rot that we have here and the just wanton corruption that is showing signs of doing nothing but ramping up and ramping up. So I think there are steps we can definitely take to improve the government because it's not, like we said before, it's not just going to go away. You can't just fight the power to a level where you're going to topple the government anytime soon without a tremendous amount of bloodshed.
Yeah.
So, I mean, people in Denmark look pretty fucking happy, don't they? Like,
yes.
You know, it's like everybody's making like a minimum of $45,000 a year and everybody's going to college for free. And I don't know. Yeah. I think we can do better for sure.
You touched on two things that I think are interesting. I've been really getting into this idea recently of the minimum wage, but the basic income, the basic salary. it sounds so weird. Like the math doesn't compute, because when I think of a system, I think people paying taxes is the money that goes into the government, and then that's how things get done. And you're telling me that we're going to have a basic income where everybody's going to just get money? Well, they're never going to pay more taxes than they get. So how does this system work? But actually, you know, I had it explained to me pretty recently, and it's basically just the opposite of trickle-down economics, because the idea of trickle-down economics is, oh, you give all the money to the rich people and they're going to create jobs and they're going to invest it. No, they don't. They just have bigger fucking bank accounts. That's what we were just talking about. Like it's increased, their wealth is increasing, not decreasing. They're not sharing. So the idea of the basic income is you give everybody money, people have to meet their needs in this society. So that money is going to get spent in their local community and get circled around the local community rather than just sitting up at the top. And it is a really interesting idea, because the money flows up. We know that. We can't stop it. The capitalism, since its inception, has been concentrating power and wealth. That's what it does. But when you give the basic income out, now the money, it'll eventually get to the top, but let's start it at the bottom. Why start it at the top? Mm-hmm. You know, I actually think it's a really great idea, and I need to learn more about the numbers there, but just that basic principle of, you know, we know where the money will end up, so let's start it on the opposite end. Like, that is genius in my eyes compared to what we've seen for basically this whole entire round of recorded human history.
Yeah, man. And another thing that those countries do to accomplish that is, how many people did you say, Greg, before 68 that hold?
85, I think, is the number. 80-something.
Yeah.
Are
you going to lose sleep at night if our government taxes the shit out of those people to make society better and to keep people out of squalor? Because if their profits are going to go down from 2 billion or 5 billion a year to like 1 billion a year, I'm sorry, that's completely fine by me. You know, I'm not going to get up in the middle of the night in a cold sweat going, oh shit, this just isn't fair. You know, it's like,
and they shouldn't either. Like, they shouldn't either. That's the problem, is we talk about it like, well, it's not fair to them. Yeah, it is. They got a billion in the bank. It is fair for them. Like, it's cool. They're not losing anything. Their money is going to sit in the bank from today to the day they die, and then it's going to go into their kids' bank and probably never get spent in their lifetime either. So it's fine. We're not taking anything away from them, because everything that they want is gotten to them by money as a resource. And we're not going to take away so much money from them that they're not going to have an infinite supply. So it's cool.
Amen, well, man.
Well, you know, when we talk about the state with all of this stuff, one thing that I always like think about is that, considering that so many like the news outlets are basically kind of state run at this point, right? I mean, it's like Rupert Murdoch owns like 85% of the news media or whatever.
Yeah.
It's like, when you guys listen to things about the economy, when you listen to things about Ebola outbreak, when you listen to things about ISIS, how much of this do you think we're just reacting to propaganda, or how much of this is actually like genuine news? Like, how do you guys even make the distinction? Because at this point, I honestly, and I would like to consider myself an educated guy, I can't tell the fucking difference between what's propaganda and what's news.
I start with the basic premise that it's all a lie, and then I wait to see if they can prove to me that it isn't. Usually they can't. So I don't get upset really about anything unless I see it in my own life. If I knew a person who got Ebola, I'd be upset. If I knew someone who lost an arm in the Boston bombing, I would be bothered. But in my life, I don't see this disaster that we're all talking about. I haven't seen it. I don't see the disease. Not a lot of problems in my network. And so I like to focus on that. And we'll, you know, if it creeps in, then I'll watch the news and study it up. But I come from the basic premise that they're lying to me first.
Yeah, man. News is just disaster porn. You know, it's the old cliche of, if it bleeds, it leads. And that's what we're going to sit there and talk about and prognosticate about over and over and over and over again until it, you know, forms synapses of worry in your brain. And you sit there and start talking to your friends about Ebola when there's no Ebola for thousands of miles near you. Right. It's just, you know, it's the old journalistic mainstay of agenda setting. You know, you can't think about anything but the things you know about. And, you know, then there's also the pressure from one news organization reports this, therefore we don't want to miss out on the scoop, so we're going to report it too. And it turns into this just like recursive feedback loop of bullshit, disaster porn information. And you don't know anything other than that. But thank God, again, we have resources to go to that are outside of this now, because people never used to have this option. You know, there's the, you know, one of the great examples of this is how marijuana became illegal. You know, William Randolph Hearst owned so many of the, you know, information outlets and newspapers at the time that he could just spin this false racist marijuana propaganda and cause everybody, you know, to believe this shit. And we don't live in that world anymore, thank God.
Mm-hmm.
But we still do. We just have this other outlet now, right? I mean, being independent media, internet, that sort of thing. But it's still going on. I mean, if you go to the water cooler at your local job, you know, or whatever, it's like chances are you're going to be talking about Ebola. Chances are you're going to be talking about what, you know, whatever the news, you know, blip of the day is, right?
Right. That is true.
And so that's you're talking about. I mean, let's just call a spade a spade. That's mass mind control. Right?
Absolutely. You're right. It totally is. It totally is. And that is not a conspiracy theorist angle.
No.
That directly is implanting a thought in your mind until you hear Ebola, 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 and you turn to the person next to you and you go, Ebola. You know, that literally is that. And I understand that, you know, there's this this kind of highly poor way to think about information called the hypodermic needle theory, meaning like you're exposed to information and they're injecting that directly into your mind and controlling your mind. And that's not what's happening. But again, you can't think about anything except for the things you know about. And mm-hmm. if you only know about the things that you're hearing in mainstream media, that is what you're going to talk about.
Yeah.
Okay.
Big conspiracy is all about limiting options. And you know, if you want to propagandize the people, yeah, Rupert Murdoch's going to have to own a good chunk of the media. But that's if you don't count the thousands of websites that people can get their information from.
So can we speculate a little bit here, or maybe not speculate, I don't know, on if, you know, if somebody's setting the precedent here, right? Somebody's setting this forward. It's like, okay, today it's going to be Ebola. That's going to be the big fear. The big question that comes up with a lot of conspiracy theorists is, who is it? And then we point to the Illuminati, it's the Freemasons, it's the Zionists, it's the Bilderbergs, whatever. It's like, what? I mean, obviously you guys have been dealing with this for a while. What's your take on this?
Mike?
I don't know, man. I think there's just so many interests like caught up in this storm of, you know, momentum and desire and money that are just continuing to propagate this whole structure forward and allowing it to continue in the way that it is. And I'm not saying that there are no shadowy dealings behind the scenes. I don't know. I obviously don't know. Anybody who says they do know is probably lying to you to some mm-hmm. extent, or is probably making too many assumptions. I truly don't know, but from what I can see, there are absolutely these people who have an unbelievably huge vested interest in keeping things the way they are, holding down innovation, holding down technologies that are going to change things from the way they are right now. And they would be stupid not to. If you had billions of dollars in the bank that rely on oil, you know, continuing to be the number one most important driving force in the economy, you're going to do everything in your power to ensure that things stay that way. You're going to buy elections. You're going to buy politicians. You're going to buy ads. You're going to buy news networks. That's just logical. From a standpoint of pure capitalism, that's just logical. So I can say with a high level of certainty, that is for sure going on based on all factual evidence. As far as the more conspiratorial, shadowy angle, again, like Greg said, that's fun to speculate about, and I love talking about that kind of stuff, but I don't fucking know.
Well, I would say there are things you can look at to get a much better idea, and one of those would be people's memberships to secret societies. Because I guess I would say that from Egypt to now, secret societies, Freemasons, the Skull and Bone Society, Knights Templar, the various priesthoods of Egypt. Priesthoods and banking have a really strong connection in ancient times, which is very strange to me, but I see religion as mind control and money as physical control over someone's life because you limit their options. So these control networks are ancient, and the Vatican, I mean, that's its own zip code. The Pope wears Prada slippers and has a gold palace. Like, you know, not a lot's changed in 5,000 years. I do think if you can look at the power pyramid, and you can get pretty high up on it just by examining those threads. Why was Kerry and Bush both in the Skull and Bones? That election, we only had a choice between two Skull and Bones members. We have things like the Council on Foreign Relations, you know, these kind of think tanks. They're pretty high up there. I think you can kind of see that they are all working towards a similar goal. But I would say something that's changed in the past 100 years is, instead of looking specifically into secret societies, and the ancient banking networks, you got to look at CEOs now, because all these people are running companies. You got to look at Monsanto, Viacom, Exxon, Merck Vaccines, DuPont, GE. These companies, you know, you can list about 20 companies, and you can have almost all the decisions on the planet will be made within those companies. You got your major food corporations, you got your banking networks, you got your media conglomerates. These are the elite. This is the power pyramid. This is the big conspiracy, because all these things work together. So I do think it's pretty easy to get pretty high up there and get a kind of a good idea on what's going on. But I do also believe there's probably, and this would be speculation, there's a network behind the curtain, behind even the public face, that you don't see. That gets pretty conspiratorial. The idea that a lot of these old networks are actually doing strange magic rituals and occult knowledge, a big part of it is to communicate with some non-human entity, something like the Archons that are talked about, or maybe the Anunnaki on some other dimensional plane. And the idea might be that they get their orders, so to speak, from some higher dimensional entity. Now, that's real speculative and really crazy, but when you look at religion and this, you know, going back to the idea that the banking networks are really connected with religions, well, in behind the scenes, they were doing some weird stuff and communicating with, or trying to do seances and stuff like that. And when you look at all three major religions, if that God is a positive entity, there's a lot of negativity on the planet. But if you think of the idea of the deity flip and that somehow they've got us all worshiping negative entities, the state of the world makes a lot more sense. So that's the kind of speculation that I get really into, but it is tough to know. But I do think you can get kind of high up there just by looking at major CEOs and stuff like that.
Yeah, man. And since you are going down the rabbit hole, that is for sure. A lot of what you said is for sure true. I mean, you look at things like Bohemian Grove or something, you know, all these high powered people getting together and like burning an owl effigy and, you know, going through some kind of ceremony with saying special words. And it's like, these things do happen. It's not like they don't happen. These things have been exposed and filmed, and, you know, people have been confirmed to go to these things that have high levels of power. Like, there's no doubt that these things go on. Whether or not they're directly influencing things in a modern context, I'm not sure. I don't know. You know, that's where the disconnect is for me. Because you see these things, you know, people still freak out about Freemasons and think they're devil worshippers. They're, you know, running the world from behind the scenes. But by all, you know, practical markers, their membership is down. People in positions of power aren't Freemasons as regularly as they used to be. So it's hard to know, like, where the line is, because yes, these things exist. Yes, you can dig into them. Yes, you can find tons of examples of powerful people who are involved in them. But how powerful are they still from a practical standpoint?
I don't know. It makes me wonder, like, how powerful, because once again, it goes back to education. Like, okay, how powerful is the information? When we talk about, like, seance, magic rituals, Bohemian Grove, right? Obviously, astrology has a lot to do with this. What I'm trying to say is, like, sacred geometry and gematria, that sort of thing has to do with this. It seems like this is the knowledge base that these powerful people work off of. And, you know, Greg, as you were saying before, that, you know, well, this is in the Bible, you know, take the fruit from the knowledge of good and evil, that everything has a good and evil aspect into it. And it seems like most people that look into conspiracies look at all these things and just automatically perceive them as evil. And what I'm trying to do is say that no, it's not good or evil. It's just information and just knowledge, you know? So once again, it kind of gets back to this whole educate people about this. The idea that, you know, currently in science, in, you know, even like in modern media, things like that, modern academia, things like astrology, gematria, sacred geometry, these sorts of things are blown off, I think is just absolutely asinine, you know? And it seems to me that these are the things that are, these secret societies, these people that are in positions of power, these are the things that they're studying. You know, I mean, when we look at Skull and Bones, why is there a 322 on there? Well, that, you know, I did a video on Skull and Bones to show why 322. That's not good or evil. They just happen to use it for evil, in my opinion.
Oh, totally agree, man. And that's why I love your work. I think that you are in a new category of researcher or lecturer that knows how to do that, who talks about the tools rather than loading it up with some preconceived notions, because that's what I try to do on the show, is have those guests on. You know, oh, there's a lot of Freemasons out there. Well, let's look at the Freemasons and their information, you know, their sacred geometry. Let's look at that and see what it's all about. You know, you see a lot of occult symbolism in Hollywood. Well, let's look at some of these magical orders. Let's look at the Lima. Let's look at Chaos Magic. Let's look at the AA and the OTO. Let's see what's up, you know, instead of just being afraid of them. Let's look at them. Let's talk to some people who are involved in them and see if we can find anything in them that isn't so scary. And I think, that's the name of the game these days.
And that's I'm sorry. You know, Greg, that's why one of the reasons I really like your show is that you're going to have somebody on like Randall Carlson, who's going to talk about, you know, the glory of sacred geometry. And then you might have Michael Tesserion, who's going to talk about, you know, the female Illuminati or something like that, you know, where you're going to get both perspectives, because in order to really educate yourself, you're going to need both perspectives, right?
Right.
Yeah. And let's not forget, too, that at the time that a lot of these secret societies were established, like the Freemasons and their various offshoots, you could still be burned at the stake for looking at the wrong thing or reading the wrong thing, or just like not, prior to the Reformation, just not being Catholic. Like, you could just be tortured and burned to death.
You could even own a Bible.
Or trying to read the Bible or translate the Bible. That was enough to get you murdered, you know? So it's really, when you look at it from that standpoint, there was, why did Nostradamus do all of his predictions in a dead language in quatrains? Because he was not allowed to do what he was doing. He needed to cloak what he was doing, because he literally probably would have been imprisoned and tortured for like scrying or whatever it was that he was doing. And the great thing is now we live in a time where you're at least most likely not going to be physically grabbed up and tortured in the country that we live in, at least, for just talking about what you want to talk about or exploring the areas that you want to explore. And I mean, even Freemasons, people who are bound by, you know, literally bound by an oath to not spread secrets, the vast majority of them in this day and age will sit down and just talk to you about their rituals, their rites, their, you know, the various degrees and ceremonies involved. Like, we've all probably had Freemasons on our shows that have spilled beans that would have used to have been completely off limits. You know, we just live in a post barrier time now, where all that information is available. So I think that might be another reason why, you know, we're seeing, you know, kind of the slow fading of some of these organizations.
You can catch the rest of that audio on part two of this broadcast. Thanks for listening, everybody. Our outro song is called Gypsy and is provided by the Madison, Wisconsin band The Moon Gypsies. This band is no longer together, but I wanted to play this song because it's just a fantastic, well-produced song, and I love all the players in this band. The bassist Mary Gaines and her husband Chris Wagoner are phenomenal musicians. They still play all around the Madison area. The guitarist Robert J. Conway is a prolific songwriter and has written for the likes of Steve Miller. And the one-time drummer Mauro Magellan is a good friend of mine and is a killer blues rock drummer who plays with bands such as The Jimmies and Dan Baird. You can check out a few of their records at www.allmusic.com and just look up The Moon Gypsies. Coming up in the next episode of the Marty Leeds Mathematical Radio Hour will be author of the Giza Template, Edward Nightingale. Make sure to stay tuned and always remember, an opinion without pie is just an onion. Thanks.
You've been listening to the Marty Leeds Mathmagical Radio Hour. More information about the work of Marty Leeds can be found at MartyLeeds33.com. You can download his full-length studio record, Opus Medico Musica, from iTunes or Amazon.com. And be sure and check out his books, Pi and the English Alphabet, Volume 1 and 2, and The Peacock's Tales, available at MartyLeeds33.com and Amazon. For hours of free video, check out his YouTube channel at MartyLeeds33. More information about SyncBook Press, SyncBook Radio, or SyncBook Events can be found at thesyncbook.com. If you like this podcast, please support it by becoming a donor. You'll find the donation links under each episode on the website and consider setting up a monthly charge. Thanks so much, and though some people think it's a piece of cake, we all know it's easy as pie.